Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Bon dia, I ora nā, hafa a day and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, anticipation as to who will be Tonga's next Prime Minister. It's Budget Day in Papua New Guinea and a damning report calling governments across the Pacific to strengthen civic freedoms for those within media. And a remote atoll may help prove its ancestral status to East Polynesia. All that and more shortly, but I'm your host Aggie Tupou, and as always, we acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Our team says, see your smas. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Tonga this morning, where votes have been counted, seats have been filled, and there's anticipation over who will form government and most importantly be elected as Prime Minister. Under Tonga's constitution, an interim speaker will soon be appointed to oversee the nomination and secret ballot for the next Prime Minister. So what happens between now and the selection of a new PM, and who are the front runners? To find the answers to those questions, let's cross over to the Tongan capital, Nuku'alofa, to join ABC's reporter there, Marion Koppel. Marion Fefe. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us this morning, Marion. I know that we're in the post-election period. Do you mind walking us through, though, the key constitutional steps that'll have to happen before Tonga has a new Prime Minister?
Yes. So since the Tonga now is, like what you said, is into the formal post-election process. So within 7 days of the official announcement of the results, that's since last week, Thursday, the King must appoint an interim speaker, and this person cannot be an elected MP. The next step after electing an interim speaker is the return of the writ. Now, just to be clear, the return of the writ simply means the election is officially finished, the final results have been certified and handed back to the King. That's when the countdown to choosing the next Prime Minister actually begins. Now, from the return of the writ, the interim speaker then has 10 days to invite all 26 elected members to submit the Prime Minister nominations, each backed or endorsed by 2 MPs. Within 3 days of those nominations closing, the interim speaker calls an elected members, or the elected members, which is the nobles and the people's rep, to vote by a secret ballot for a prime minister designate. And whoever gets more than half is recommended to the King for the formal appointment. So that's the path we're on now, Aggie. Mm.
And that looks like that could take up to maybe a week or two?
Yeah, most likely, yes. Yeah. Most likely, yes.
Marion, there's already public interest, though, in who might put their hand up for Prime Minister. I'm thinking realistically, what kind of candidates could emerge and what factors could influence their chances?
Yes, like right now, Aggie, there are already early signs of who might be stepping forward. Obviously, 2 nobles have been mentioned, the current Speaker of the House and also the former Speaker and former Prime Minister of the House were mentioned. Lord Vaya made this publicly a few weeks ago, although neither noble has officially confirmed this. There's also other speculation around the current Prime Minister, Isaac Eke, of course, and also former Prime Minister Celso Sovaleni. But because of the previous tension, Aggie, that we all know between Sovaleni and the King, many MPs may be reluctant to support Sovaleni. But, you know, if the nobles do push their noble candidate, this also can mean this is a signal that their support have shifted away from Weke. And so, of course, the overall atmosphere here, including the frustration from the ongoing fuel crisis that we are currently experiencing, which caused voters delays and transport challenges like since last week, will also feed into how the MPs think about leadership and stability moving forward, Aggie. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to, you know, alliances and numbers, who can pull both the nobles and enough people's rep together to form a solid majority in Tonga's government.
Yeah, as you say, talking about elected members, you know, I know they've already started talking and forming alliances, but what key political dynamics, you know, should Tongans be watching in the lead up to actually selecting the next prime minister?
I think one of the key things to watch is the nobles' desk, the nine nobles in parliament. They have these nine seats and they only need five people's reps to cross over to form a government. So the nobles just need five MPs from the people's rep to cross over and they have a government. We also have five new people's MPs in this year, in this election, and no one quite knows where they stand politically. They could become, you know, the swinging votes in the prime minister race. Another major point that we should be also looking at, Aggie, is the speaker's role. Now, since the 2010 reform, only a noble can be speaker, and that's the big constitution reform that we taken in 2010. Only a noble can be a speaker of the house. So if nobles take the speakership and then most likely, let's say, take over the government, it will raise real questions about the separation of powers. We're talking about check and balances and whether there's enough independence between the parliament, the cabinet, and the crown. So the alliances, the noble strategy, and how the new MPs position themselves in parliament, those will all shape who becomes the next prime minister. So these are what that we, as the people of Tonga, will be watching on in the next few days, few weeks to come.
I want to loop back, though, Marion, you know, to last week's election. Unfortunately, you know, almost half of Tonga's registered voters didn't actually vote. So I'm just wondering, why was the turnout so low? And I know you did mention fuel, but was there any other issues?
Yes. So there is also a concern from the people, Aggie, that some of the people that I mentioned or registered, let's say the numbers, that are registered and read out, which is almost 65,000 people. It is said that some of those registered people are either diseased or migrated. So, in other words, the registered voters list should be updated from the Electoral Commission. I had friends telling me that they registered this year for the first time to vote, only to not have their name on the list when they came to vote. So there is some mistakes and some things need to be updated with our Electoral Commission list to come.
Okay, well, that is something, yeah, that we'll be waiting to hear the outcome of, Marion. But look, as always, malo apito, he ngāwe ofa mihena mi tonga. Malo apito.
Yeah. Malo apito, Eki. Have a great day.
You too. That is our ABC Tonga reporter, Marion Kupu, here on Pacific Beat.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whakawhetai Lassie, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, it's budget day in Papua New Guinea, with all eyes on the Treasurer, who will hand down the national budget before Parliament. The 2026 budget, according to Prime Minister James Marape, will be a reflection of the government's priorities, focusing on maintaining financial stability and consistency while strengthening services like health, education and the police. Paul Barker from the Institute of National Affairs says that despite the government earning strong revenue from the resource sector, the government is often unable to control spending. He spoke to Belinda Cora about what can be expected from today's budget.
You've had good prices, good major resource projects functioning, not many new ones, but a number of obviously some middle-sized new ones like K92 paying good taxes. And yet, despite the strong revenue base, as one would expect, you're seeing continued budget deficits. And at the end of each year, you're finding that because of weak expenditure control, you're finding the last month a lot of additional expenditure is happening. And that then disrupts the beginning of the next year. So the first quarter of the next year, instead of spending the next year's budget allocation, it's actually busily paying off the over expenditure from the end of the previous year. And that drags on into the second quarter and really is quite disruptive of each year.
I've realized that expenditure, especially in the public service core group, is really an issue for government.
We need to both better manage the forecast and manage the revenue system. We would do better not having so much of the revenue going into state-owned enterprises, some of which the Kumuls, which seem not to be particularly accountable, but also seem to be able to decide how to spend the money themselves and not transferring the money to either the government or for the government to put into the sovereign wealth fund, which was meant to be the savings and equalization mechanism that the country was meant to have. So money is accumulating in some state-owned enterprises, Kumul Petroleum, Kumul Minerals, and not getting to the government. And then the government instead is borrowing heavily from the international organizations and the domestic market financial institutions. So, they're aiming to have a balanced budget by 2027. But as I say, this problem with expenditure control, and that relates also to weak oversight control, weak, audits as well are a factor.
So what are we expecting in this year's budget?
Okay, when one conducts a budget, Treasury try to be reasonably accurate and reasonably, conservative. So in principle, they don't announce things that haven't actually been approved. So they make forecasts on what the commodity prices will be. They shouldn't go and exaggerate what those prices and therefore the revenue is actually going to be. And they also can't go and include projects that haven't actually been approved. They would like to be able to see some major new resource projects that will be able to provide some sort of economic growth stimulus and directly or indirectly some sort of boost to the revenue stream for 2026. But frankly, they won't really be able to do it for 2026 because all those big projects, whether it's Papua LNG or Wafi-Golpu, none of them are in that state yet where they're going to be actually proceeding during next year.
And that's Paul Barker, Executive Director of the Institute of National Affairs, speaking there to ABC's Belinda Cora.
Pacific Beat.
Mana Opito, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Civicus, a global civil society alliance, is calling governments in 8 countries to respect civic freedoms and strengthen institutions to protect these rights. In a damning report, it expressed concern over the restrictions on freedom of expression and access to information in Fiji, Kiribati, Nauru, Papua New Guinea, Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu. But just recently in Samoa, the government banned the country's only independent newspaper from many of its press conferences. Whenau Whanua spoke to Joseph Benedict, a researcher with Civicus Asia Pacific.
We have a range of concerns that we have continued to see in the last couple of years, particularly around freedom of expression, press freedom, access to information, but also other challenges faced by civil society, including criminal defamation laws that are used against them, as well as the lack of institutions, so the lack of national human rights institutions, as well as the failure to ratify international treaties. So we are highlighting that there are positive. There's overall a positive development, but there are also challenges that we want to see Pacific Island states address here.
I want to focus on Samoa in particular, just because I don't know if you've heard, over the last week, their only independent newspaper was banned from attending any prime minister press conferences. How concerning is this? Do you think this represents growing autocracy in the region and in Samoa?
I think this reflects our larger concern around the restrictions faced by journalists and the restrictions on press freedom in the region. I mean, we have seen incidents of harassment, intimidation of journalists, some being dismissed after reporting on particular issues, but also being denied visas to travel to particular countries. So obviously what's happened with the Samoa Observer is quite concerning, and we are calling on the government to retract, you know, this particular instruction to restrict them. And this is not the first incident. We also saw previously where one journalist was also charged with criminal defamation for their reporting. So it's, I think, a worrying pattern where journalists are not protected because it's so essential for the Pacific to have an open space for journalists and the media to report on issues.
The Samoan government implemented this ban, saying that they weren't going to tolerate defamation and that the press was overstepping. But could you expand further on why it's so important for governments in the region to respect their independent media and allow them to have full access to these press conferences?
The media is very important. It's the oxygen of democracy in many countries. The media allows people to be informed of issues that they are facing, laws and policies being proposed by the government. It also allows the government to hear from citizens around the country on what's happening. So by restricting such a key news outlet like the Samoa Observer, it basically restricts access to information to many of its citizens with regards to information about what's happening with the government and the broader society. Definitely, this is quite a very dangerous move by the government. And I think ultimately what we want to see is that media have access to all parts of government, parliament, and other spaces within society, so that they're able to report on issues without fear of being banned, restricted, or reprisals. And again, this is a pattern we are seeing not just in Samoa, but in a number of other countries in the Pacific.
And in your statement, you mentioned the need to establish human rights institutions. Could you expand on that?
So national human rights institutions are very critical. They play a role in advising government around the laws and policies that they put forward, but they also play a check and balance role in holding governments to account whenever they commit violations of human rights. Unfortunately, in a number of countries in the Pacific, including Kiribati, Nauru, Solomon Islands, and Vanuatu, there is no national human rights institution. And this is despite the UN and other states calling for this for a number of years. So I think it's very important that these governments take this call very seriously. Many a time we hear lip service from the government saying, oh yes, we will set this up. But I think it's important that citizens have a space where they can file complaints about human rights violations, and that action is seriously taken. So the establishment of national human rights institutions is very important across the Pacific.
Another interesting thing you pointed out was that Fiji, PNG and Samoa have used cybercrime laws to criminalize online expression. This is not unique to the Pacific. We've seen it in parts of the world where concerns over cybercrime has led to stricter laws on freedom of expression. Could you describe this?
Sure, yeah. So we are seeing, as you said, globally, a move towards using criminal defamation laws or cyber crime laws in order to go after people who speak up, who criticize government, who question. For a long time, we know these laws were not in the Pacific, but now and now we are seeing more and more countries passing such laws. And we've also seen incidents of governments using these laws against journalists and human rights defenders. Let me give you one example. In December of last year, a human rights defender from Papua New Guinea, Eddie Tanago, was arrested under the Cybercrime Act just for posting a message online on his Facebook about what was happening in the Forest Authority in Papua New Guinea. He was arrested and held in his cell before being released later. So these are laws that are being used to harass activists and journalists. And what it does is it creates a chilling effect where people are afraid to speak up online. So we are calling for the repeal of these cybercrime laws in order to ensure there is space for freedom of expression.
And that there is Joseph Benedict, a researcher with Civicus Asia Pacific. At 5:30, level 4, joining us here on Pacific Beat. This time is, of course, where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. Today we have a new surprise in the studio. Usually it is Carl Evans, but we've got the man, Finau Fonua, joining us this morning. How are you doing?
I'm good, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you for waking up early and having to join me this morning. I know it's not your usual, but appreciate it. We're going to get straight into it. One of the stories here, we start off in New Caledonia, where pro-independence proponents, they've actually rebuked efforts by the French government to grant the territory greater autonomy. Tell us more.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing dispute. But in a statement issued yesterday, the Kanak and Socialist National Liberation Front, or FLNKS, which is New Caledonia's largest pro-independence party, they said they would continue to reject the Bougainville Accord. So the Bougainville Accord was an agreement drafted in France in July between the French government and pro-independence and loyalist factions. To give New Caledonia greater autonomy. This statement from the FLNKS, it comes a week after a visit by France's Minister for Overseas, Naima Mocho, who engaged in consultations with the FLNKS. She indicated the French government would enshrine the Bougainville Accord in its constitution with a referendum held in New Caledonia to decide on whether it should be recognized. But the FLNKS says the Bougainville Accord is being implemented without consensus and they won't accept anything less than a clear path towards an independence referendum.
Yeah, which I know we were discussing this yesterday with journalist Nick McLennan, and I think that referendum is set for March the 15th. So, but he's saying it doesn't seem like it'll be a positive outcome.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's head to Kiribati. A memorial for the World War II battle was held. What's the history behind this?
Yes, this is the Battle of Tarawa, occurred in 1943 between the 20th and 23rd of November. It was a four-day battle, but it's well known as one of the most brutal battles of World War II. Over 1,000 American soldiers died. More than 2,500 Japanese soldiers perished. Only 17 Japanese soldiers surrendered, were captured in that battle. More than 2,000 Korean construction workers who were forcibly conscripted were also killed. It's one of the few battles where there were more American casualties than Japanese. And a lot of photographs and videos of that battle were taken. The Japanese ambassador and Korean ambassador to Kiribati attended the memorial services, as well as the U.S. one. And at the end of the ceremony, the Japanese embassy stated they hoped that this ceremony would continue as a symbol of friendship between Kiribati, Korea, America, and them as well. Yeah, they said a symbol of human effort for the peace of the world.
Beautiful. Okay, well, thank you for that story. Finau, this one here, though, some sport news. Paul Gallen has called for life bans in wake of a disgraceful Eliezer Gato incident. You have to elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes, this is the incident that unfortunately occurred about 3 weeks ago. Eliezer Gato, who left the game between Matamatonga and Toa Samoa on a stretcher, and his career, his season for next year has been, he won't be playing.
Unfortunately.
The Melbourne Storm announced that, I think, a week ago. But NRL legend Paul Gallen, he's just one of a few who've come out condemning the fact that Eliezer Gato was allowed to play in that game because he had been concussed 3 times. He was actually knocked out before he even took the field.
That's right.
There's an investigation going on as to who should be held responsible. But Gallen said anyone found to be negligent in the handling of that, should face a lifetime ban. This has struck a chord with a lot of the NRL legends, including Sean Johnson, Jonathan Thurston. They've come out, sharing the same sentiment as Paul Gallen.
Yeah, that is very unfortunate. But, what's, I suppose, good about the outcome, though, is the outpouring of love for Eliezer and obviously what happened and whatnot. But, again, we were witness to what actually happened. Yes. And I feel for the man because obviously his career is sort of hanging in the balance, right?
Yes, and it's captivated the whole rugby league world from Papua New Guinea, Samoa, New Zealand, Australia. Nobody wants to see that in rugby league.
Really do hope that he does, I suppose, make a major comeback. And again, that'll totally be up to Eliezer himself. But thank you for bringing those stories, Finau, as always. Those are just a couple of your headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat. Just coming up also, apologies, it's giving you a quick update on what's been on the show already. Anticipation as to who will be Tonga's next Prime Minister. We've been talking about the budget day in Papua New Guinea and also that damning report calling governments across the Pacific to strengthen civic freedoms for those within media. Still to come though, excitement brews for our Pacific teams and matches announced ahead of the Rugby League World Cup for 2026. And where do the origins of Eastern Polynesia come from?
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To sport now. Well, as if the recent clash between Toa Samoa and Tonga in the Pacific Rugby League Championships wasn't big enough, just imagine what the atmosphere will be like when the arch rivals meet in the World Cup next year. That game has been confirmed now and will be the third of Samoa's 3 pool matches following a match against France in Sydney and a trip to Port Moresby to take on the PNG Kumuls. Tonga will take on England first up in Perth and then Lebanon before the Polynesian Derby. Toa Samoa's head coach Ben Gardner is not entirely sure how the organisers came up with what is a slightly unusual tournament format, but he says the task ahead is clear.
The France game we play prior to the Australian women's team, so that should be a pretty big day at Combank with 4 teams that have followed throughout the world playing there. So we play 5:45 that day, and then that'll set us up nicely to head to Port Moresby. And then when we come back to Tonga, back to Combank, that's an evening game, which is a good one, because that sort of sets you up leading into the finals for big match occasion, big match style. And what better way to play that type of game, one of our biggest rivals in Tonga.
everybody, I think, will be out to prove a point of one sort or another. I mean, Papua New Guinea, of course, would have liked to crack at Tonga during the recent Pacific Championships, but the rules as they stand didn't allow. Tonga, of course, will be out for revenge against yourselves. And you, of course, will be looking to take the team to the World Cup.
The best teams walk towards pressure, and that's what we think that we've been preparing for over the last 3 years, is to walk towards pressure in a situation where pretty much every game's a must-win circumstance. You know, just because of the way that the tournament's been put together, you pretty much need to win all of your games to go to the next step. And, you know, that's sort of what we've been planning to do and what we've been building over the last 3 years. It's a very different team that we've got to the last World Cup, so it's not comparable, and I don't think it's comparable for any of the teams. It's about this World Cup and what you've probably done over the last couple of years to prepare yourselves to be in the best position once you get there.
What do you feel you have to do between now and the World Cup to be absolutely in A1 condition when you get there as a squad? And what will time allow you to do? Will you play another match between now and the World Cup, for example?
No, we won't, is the answer. No one will, I don't think. And, you know, maybe England will, maybe France will. But the way that the NRL program works, and all of our players, bar a couple in our squad being NRL players, they have to sit in the window of the NRL international season. So unfortunately, we won't have a lead-up game. We'll be making sure that our training prepares us to be at our best come the first game against France. And that's just how it is. Like, you know, any of the nations that have NRL players need to put themselves in a position where those players won't be available until the first World Cup match. And that's just the nature of the circumstance. So it's really no different to the preparations we've had for the three tournaments over the last 3 years. Like, you go straight into the tournament and you have to be ready to go. And that's part of why you keep a consistent staff and a consistent playing group, so the combinations remain strong throughout your 3 or 4 year lead up to the World Cup. And that's what we identified after the last World Cup. We do need to build those combinations through playing games, and, you know, it'd be lovely to have a warm-up match, but the rules with the, you know, the RLPA rules and the NRL rules don't allow it.
So therefore, is it unreasonable to suggest that at the moment in the world of rugby league, the club game comes first and the international game comes second, and yet your side, with the talent that is available to you, huge expectations on those players, but to just turn up and play, as it were, I mean, it's not easy, is it?
Yeah, I think your first statement's incorrect. I don't think that it says anything about the importance of the international game versus the club game. It's something that's been put into place to try and protect the players in how many games they play throughout a season. And so what the Rugby League Players Association has been able to do is put a window in place to allow players to play in that window, so we take advantage of playing in that window for internationals. At the end of the day, if your training should put you in a position to be ready to play your best performance in the first game of the tournament anyway. And that's sort of what we've been trying to build over the last couple of years, is making sure that when we start our first test match, we're ready to play our best football. We're not having to warm to it. And that's probably some lessons that some of the players in the team took from the last World Cup.
Do you think with the talent that you have available, and of course there's always the possibility there may be other players who decide to declare that they're available for Toa Samoa as well over the next year or so, you have the talent to win the World Cup?
I think that our whole aim throughout the last 4 years has been to build our way to be in a position to win the World Cup. Part of that has been building our program. Part of that has been building our staff. Part of that has been building our players, and not only, you know, adding players from other nations, but also adding younger players into our squad. So we've been able to develop that program to put ourselves in a position to win the World Cup. There's been no accident in how we've gone about it. It's all been very intentional, and it's to put ourselves in the best position on the biggest day under the biggest pressure.
And the fact that you will be playing in a tournament in Australia, and we've already seen the level of support that you can generate, and you're not going to be short of fans, are you? That's for sure. Possibly in PNG, no, it might be slightly different.
We're not going to be short of fans, and that's one of the biggest and most exciting parts. I think even in PNG, reading on the social media stuff over the last few days, people are already booking their flights and their accommodation to be ready for the game over there. So, you know, we'll have a huge following in Western Sydney when we play the two games there. That last match against Tonga on the 1st of November, I think most people throughout the world should be putting that in their diary, because that's going to be a spectacle.
And that's Ben Gardner, head coach of Toa Samoa, talking to Richard Ewart about what will surely be a mighty clash against Tonga at the Men's Rugby League World Cup next year. Just a note for PNG fans, confirmation that as well as Samoa, they'll also play Lebanon and Port Moresby in the pool round, and England and Wollongong, while Cook Islands and Fiji will line up against each other with New Zealand and the current champions, Australia.
Well, Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, is world famous for its giant stone statues, known as the Moai. But where did the idea of this type of ancient Polynesian worship come from? Well, that's the question anthropologist Carl Lupo has been trying to answer through his research, which aims to find the Polynesian homeland. And the search for that answer recently took Carl and a team of researchers to one of the remotest communities in the Pacific. We have Carl joining us this morning. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning.
Appreciate your time this morning. I know you're joining us from Binghamton University in the eastern United States. I have to ask, why did your search lead you to Ontong Java in Solomon Islands?
Yeah, it's a good question because it seems like a very unlikely place when you think about Easter Island as being the eastern part of the Pacific and Ontong Java is so far west, so it's sort of an unlikely place to start. But you know, we started with the question: where did this idea of giant statues come from? Where the Polynesians brought it with them? They brought this tradition across the Pacific, across eastern Polynesia. But where is the source of that? And the answer started with actually a linguist, Pilo Wilson, who's at the University of Hawaii in Hilo. He sort of looked at the language evidence and found that his best account for the origins of Eastern Polynesian languages are actually what are in the central northern outliers, of which Ontong Java is a central part of. So a really linguistic connection that led us to this idea.
And I suppose when you were on this, excavation, was there any challenges, though, that you faced while there?
Oh, absolutely. it's a place, it's such a remote island that, one of the reasons no one's really investigated this before is it's so hard to get to. There's not regular ferry service. There's not planes. You have to basically catch a freighter that may or may not come every couple of months and then may or may not come, pick you up later. You know, it's just been really remote. In fact, the last sort of systematic study of the island took place in the 30s, really many, many decades ago. It's literally because it's so remote and difficult to get to. So just that was the biggest challenge to begin with. How are we going to get there? Where are we going to stay? How are we going to get permission from the islanders to even do this work when it's such a remote place? So that was one of the biggest challenges.
While I was reading into it, I know that you guys weren't the first ones to discover this, but there was a team from Germany. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, back in the early 20th century, in the 1908 and 10, the Germans were, sailing around, doing ethnographic and sort of natural history studies of the islands of Micronesia. And they came to the island and did sort of an extensive study that really documented the ethnographic history, the artifacts, material culture, but really didn't do any archaeology, but documented sort of the best case of what was going on at the time. And that gave us hints that there were some really interesting things that were going on there materially that could be connected to statues.
We talk a lot about climate change, right? So I'm just wondering, has that, even environmental change, did that add a bit of an urgency, given the places like Ontong Java that could be affected by rising sea levels? Was that part of your investigation?
Oh, absolutely. Because, this question about the origins of Eastern Polynesian people and the language and their traditions, if they came from these remote, tiny atolls, we needed to really look at those places before they go away. I mean, the atolls are only a couple of meters above sea level. They're the first that are going to be hit by changes in sea level. And if we didn't get there at some point soon, it may be a point where no one will ever know. And this, sort of vital question will never be answered. So we really figured we needed to go there and start doing this work. Otherwise, it would remain a mystery.
And one of those findings in Ontong Java was the giant Pacific rat. I'm like, what does the presence of this rodent tell you about our ancient Polynesian migration paths?
That's a great question. The rat seems like, how can that tell you about humans? One interesting trait that we found really everywhere across Polynesia is that as Polynesians moved from island to island, they brought with them, whether it was on purpose or just sort of a stowaway, the Polynesian rat. And this is Rattus excellens, a small little arboreal rat that lives in trees and loves palm nuts. So each set of canoes seem to have brought a series of rats with them. And through the genetics of looking at those rats, we can actually trace where people went to and what sequence of islands they moved across the Pacific. So it's a really kind of great tracer of population movement. And we found Rattus excellens remains in the excavations we did at Ontong Java. And now we're anxiously waiting genetic evidence to sort of look and see if we can see that pattern.
Wow. If you've just joined us, my guest this morning is anthropologist Professor Kalupo from Binghamton University. We're discovering the origins of Polynesia, or mostly, I suppose, around Eastern Polynesia. Carl, when most researchers think that the homeland of Polynesians is Samoa, but you've ruled this out, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the traditional story, is that, you know, these big islands in Tonga and Samoa are the homeland of Eastern Polynesians, so the direct homeland of Eastern Polynesians. And it makes sense in the perspective of this is a large landmass, lots of people, and that this would have been a good source of populations. But when we look at the details, things just don't add up that was the direct place from which people left. We don't see, the language doesn't match up, as Pila Wilson has really documented. And when we look at the material culture, we don't see many of the things that we find elsewhere across Eastern Polynesia. For example, in Rapa Nui, in Easter Island, we see the giant statues, these giant anthropomorphic figures, and we don't see that kind of tradition in Samoa. And if people, we know that people brought this tradition with them because we see it in multiple islands, large statue construction. So it can't be, if it's not in Samoa, it must have come from somewhere else. People brought that with them. So we've been looking for where would we have find those early origins? Where's the place that people must have started with this tradition? And it doesn't look like it's Samoa.
Mm. I feel, though, obviously, you know, while you're on your excavation journey, that the trip sort of felt like a needle in the haystack, right? You know, you're down there on the dirt trying to find things, you know, to indicate what could be connected to us present. I mean, like, yeah, what was that sort of process like for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, the atoll, Anton Java is the world's largest atoll, and it's, you know, some 50 miles around. It's a gigantic, gigantic atoll. It's only a couple hundred meters across, a little wider at some places than others. But we had to excavate, dig a hole somewhere across this huge area where we might find evidence of the earliest occupation of the island, because we were really looking at for when did people first get there and what, you know, what are the traits of those people? And so, you know, where do you start? I mean, every hole you dig could be 6 inches from the evidence you're looking for. So we had to be really careful to figure out, to do some coring and to do some sort of landscape analysis to try to figure out where is the best possible location that could potentially find that evidence. And we were lucky. We actually found 2 meters deep of deposits with radiocarbon dates going down, and now we're in the process of analyzing them. But it really was a needle in the haystack operation that we, you know, we just guessed.
And what was it like having to be able to sort of interact, I suppose, with the people there? What stories were they able to tell you?
It was a really fantastic opportunity to work with the people there. I mean, their interest, you know, they don't know a lot of the, you know, their own history in the sense of where did they come from, and a lot of that knowledge has been lost over the years. And they're very deeply interested in it because they're Polynesians. You know, this is really close to the Solomon Islands, which are Melanesian, very different languages. But here are these Polynesians living there with different kinds of traditions. They're, you know, trying to understand their origin is something that's very, very important to them. And really understanding their central role in the colonization of Eastern Polynesia is particularly important as they're trying to, they need to raise their profile to say, this place matters. It's some place that, you know, we can't afford to lose with climate change, and we need to document this and understand that. So it was a really fantastic experience working with them.
Yeah. So, Carl, with that, now that you've got that sort of information, what now, I suppose, as an anthropologist, what do you use this information for, and how much can, you know, our people in the Pacific use it?
Well, I mean, part of it is understanding identity, like how are you connected to others? Polynesia is a fantastic network of people who moved across this vast space, you know, with canoes, interacting in different ways and different patterns, you know, sharing language, sharing traditions, and really connecting this lets us understand where did this come from? How did this evolve? How did the different stepping stones happen? How did these challenges of traversing this vast ocean with canoes take place. So really, you know, sort of enriching that history and sort of sharing how this amazing story that is Eastern Polynesia.
I think this reminds me a lot of, you know, like I want to take a step out of the past and maybe ask you about something maybe more present now is, you know, Disney's Moana. Do you think that's helped to maybe popularize or mainstream Polynesian history? I mean, do you think that's even reviving interest in a profession like yours?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think people see that there's, you know, this amazing culture with this incredible depth and rich of you know, rich with traditions and you know, ways of life. And, you know, certainly Moana and other, you know, sort of popular versions of that show that this incredible culture. And it's fantastic to see that spread across the world as people realize this is an amazing place and that, you know, they're small islands and they're very disparate, but they're connected in this very interesting way that deserves study and serves, you know, sort of respecting.
Yeah, very fascinating stuff to talk about this morning, Carl. That's all the time that we have, but really appreciate you coming on and sharing.
No, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. That is anthropologist Professor Carl Lupo from Binghamton University in the United States here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember, our team will be back at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow morning, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. As always, thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat. I'm your host here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.